Hi, I'm Colin Mockery, and you're listening to Improv Nerd.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Oh, hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today, you know him from both the American and British version of the show, Whose Line Is It Anyway?, Colin Mockery. As you know, Whose Line has influenced many, many generations of improvisers. So we got to talk with Colin about how he started out doing short form, doing theater sports in Canada, how it was like dealing with the censors of Whose Line when he first started, and what he really feels about all those ball jokes that those guys make. We were lucky to catch up with him at the Genesee Theater in Waukegan, Illinois, before his show with Brad Sherwood on his Scared Scriptless tour. They do a two-person improv show. But before we get to the interview, I just want to say this morning, this big news, I got up and I made the bed. Now, Lauren makes the bed every day. But today, since she was taking care of Betsy, I wanted to do something special for her as a surprise. And so I made the bed, and I didn't say anything because I wanted her to find out, you know, what a nice surprise. And so I did that probably around 9:30. Then we got together for lunch. She still hadn't mentioned anything, not like I care. And then she asked me, she said, so are you ready to record the intros and outros, which is what I'm doing right now? And do you have a story you want to tell? And I said, well, I think I'm going to say that I made the bed today and you didn't notice. And she goes, no, I noticed. I haven't had a chance to say that I noticed. And she said, you know, and I just want to let you know that when I do things, I want you to notice as well. So like when I make dinner, you know, she said when she makes dinner, because I usually always make dinner, she says she always makes a point of saying I made dinner. So I know that she made dinner. And so when I make the bed, I this time I didn't do it, but when I empty the dishwasher or put a load of laundry in the washing machine, I always want to make sure she knows, so she knows how much I'm really doing. And the truth is, I don't do anything around here. She does a lot of stuff. She takes care of Betsy. She runs her own business. And, you know, she keeps this. She cleans the house. She keeps the house together. She does a lot of stuff. And, you know, I try to help, but let's be honest, I could do more. So I just wanted to share that with you. You're going to love this episode. And he shares this in this episode. Last week we had Brad Sherwood, and Brad talked about bombing and a story about them all bombing. So Colin tells his version of the same story. You're going to love this. Colin Mockery is just so much fun to be around. He's just got such a positive, playful energy. So here it is, the Colin Mockery episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Hey, Colin.
Hey, Jimmy.
Colin Mockery, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thank you for having me.
And it's so... I would imagine you are so much fun to play with, because before we were about to do the interview, I look in your eye and there's this twinkle in your eye and there's this smile.
I am a dream to work with. People love working with me. Sure, let's go with that.
Okay. You're from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you started doing improv at theater sports in Vancouver in 1980. Mm-hmm. And this is way before the mainstream knows about this show, Whose Line Is It Anyway? What was it like doing theater sports, which is... short form games back then, where no one knows what short form games or even what improv is, and you have to go to McDonald's and pull people out of the pull them out of McDonald's to come to see your show.
Yeah, it was really exciting. It was the beginning of improv in Vancouver. Keith Johnstone had come out and taught an improv class. And then they did a demonstration of it at a theater I was going to see a friend I think it was a one act, and then part of the evening was this theater sports thing. And I thought, wow, this looks like it would be fun. So I got involved with them pretty quickly, and it was fairly, I think I was there within the first couple of months of the league starting up. I don't think it was a league at that point. Well, I guess it was a league. And
it was competitive, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Theater sports, you would compete.
You had two teams of usually four people. There was a referee. There was three judges. The referee would issue challenges. Each team would do it, and then the refs or the judges would judge us. So it was all, it was, what I loved about it at that point was it wasn't all actors. A large portion were, but you know, one of the best guys we had was a cable installer. We had writers, we had bus drivers. It was just a group of people who were excited by this new, I'm doing air quotes, new art form. So it was exciting. The audience, and the audience at that point, we were also kind of teaching them because they had no reference level for this. There hadn't been anything really like it that they had seen. The tough part was getting an audience because we would go on 11 o'clock Friday nights after the main show. The guy who ran the theater, a man called Ray Michael, gave us a chance to do the show after his main play. And so we slowly, as you said, we would start pulling people out of the McDonald's. And I'd say within a year, we had people lining up around the block to come see it.
How were you back then as an improviser?
I think I was pretty much like every young improviser who goes out there, just totally fearless. Just went out. I think as you go along, that's when sometimes fear sort of creeps in and you get a little more. But at that point, it was like, yeah, that sounds great. Let's do that. I was probably more physical then because I was younger and my body didn't creak when I bent. So that made it more fun. But it was, I think I had the same basic, I guess, point of view. My stuff was a little more, it certainly was never cerebral. It was all very physical. It's surreal at times. And I think my best quality at that point, which I think is still one of my best ones, was I really enjoyed supporting. I really enjoyed being part of the group. It's why I never got into stand-up. I always enjoyed that, the excitement of going out on stage with nothing in front of people who have paid good money to see something, and with absolutely nothing, somehow make an evening's entertainment.
And there was something interesting you said, and I think it might have been the first time you auditioned for the British version of Whose Line, and that was you didn't get in. I think you tried three times, and you finally, on the third time, you got in. But the first time you didn't get in, you had learned something, and that was there was a different. You're laughing. What's so funny?
Well, because it's horrible in a way.
Tell me, I love horrible. This podcast is about horrible. People want to hear the horrible.
The first time I auditioned, I was at Second City. And
you had been there for a while, done a couple of reviews.
Yeah, and the producers were doing sort of a cross North America audition tour. So they saw the show, they liked everyone, so they auditioned us. And they had a flight the next day, so our audition, I think, was 9 in the morning, which is always prime time. Yeah. And at Second City, you become a night person because you're, you know, you're doing late shows and then you're hyped up after the show, so you usually hang at the theater.
Right, most improvisers are going to bed at 9 in the morning.
Yeah, exactly. So We auditioned as a cast, and at that point we'd been working together for a while, so we were doing that improv thing where you support everyone. So we were working as an ensemble, so no one stood out. So none of us got cast. And it wasn't till, it was actually the next year, my wife and I had moved down to LA because of a show she was writing and starring in, and they came through again, and I kind of went, hey, look at me. So because I
but you know, you, as you say that, as an improviser, you there's a kind of a blushing, like, oh, I did something wrong.
Yeah.
Am I picking up on that?
Yeah, because you feel like you're not supposed to showboat. You're supposed to be part of the group. And I mean, I don't think I was a showboat, but I think I upped my game a little bit. Also because I didn't know anyone I was auditioning with. It was all people I met at the audition. So I felt, because I didn't know them, I had to make stronger choices and really go for it, as opposed to when I'm working with other people, I tend sometimes to sort of hang back and let them take charge.
And then you, the second city you did, you were there for three shows. How was it taking your short form stuff and using that in Second City in terms of their whole writing process? Because it's really sketched there.
Yeah, it's the improv is mostly used as a tool. Sometimes you would go, I have an idea for I'm trying to think of an example. We had a sketch. It was about two people trying to set up a. It was an audition. It was a pitch for an advertising thing, and I said, I don't know what the thing is. It's at some point, the person they're pitching to, we accidentally kill him, and then the pitch is, how are we going to get away with it? So we improvised that, and it went all right. So then the process would be, you'd watch the tape, we used videotape in those days, and we go, okay, that's where the scene kind of went down, or that moment could have been explored a little more. So it really was sort of a tool to get to what the scene was about. As opposed to theater sports, where the improv was the scene. So it was...
Which did you prefer?
I think I enjoyed just improvising for improvising sake rather than trying to get a scene with it. I mean, I enjoyed both of them in different ways, but I think the freedom of just going out there and coming up with a scene and within the parameters of the whatever the challenge was, I found that fun because I enjoy finding ways of working within limits, but not having them limit you, if that makes any sense.
No, can you explain?
No.
Okay.
It's like, well, you have to do this scene where you can only talk in rhyme. So it's finding a way to stay to those rules, but somehow futzing with them.
Well, so somewhere. I would imagine Whose Line Is It Anyway is great for you because there's got to be a lot of rules on that show in terms of this is what you can say, this is what you can't say. When we're doing object freeze, I want you to come into this frame and that frame.
Yeah, it's not too bad technically because the crew are amazing. I think most of the cameramen are people who work either sports events or live events like the Oscars or something. So they're used to sort of going with the flow. And the director kind of knows where to look and where the action will be. The hardest thing with Whose Line was you couldn't take time to set up a scene because we didn't have that time. We had 3, maybe 5 minutes to do the scene. So you couldn't spend time working up to it, you had to sort of get to the action right away.
How did you learn that? Was that just through Hard Knocks?
Oh, sure. It's like anything with improv. The more you do it, you figure out, oh, okay, so I can't take time here. I just have to, we just get to the action. And then, which is also, I think, great for improv. And I think it's what we try to do, where you get the suggestion and you use the suggestion right away. Whereas in early days of theater sports, you would get the suggestion, and sometimes you'd work up to it. But I find if you use it right away, then that's gone. You don't have to worry about it anymore. Then you're free to explore the rest of the scene.
Now, the show you do with Brad, I would imagine you have a little more time than you would on Whose Line.
Oh, God. Yeah, our scenes sometimes go on way too long.
But I'm talking about all... Really?
Well, because we don't... first of all, we don't have anyone stopping them. We don't have...
How do you edit in this show?
He looks at you,
and you look at him, and if he looks tired
it's like,
or bored,
no, we're just looking at each other and go, oh, that's a big laugh, that's
right
there,
right?
Because early on, I think we would get caught up in, we have to have a beginning, middle, and end, and we don't always. Sometimes we stop somewhere in the middle.
Like the audience really cares, right?
Well, this is it. It's just our thing where, no, we have to tell this story.
Right.
It's like, no. No, we're there to entertain. And yes, it helps if we make a little bit of sense. But we're also kind of breaking the rules of storytelling.
You did the British version, the American version. What's the difference in terms of sensibility, the American and the British?
The British, when we were doing Whose Line, it was still a fairly new art form there.
And improv was a fairly new.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was, they're very, or they can be. I mean, of course, it's evolved there now throughout the years. But they still do this almost like in a pantomime way. They'll break the fourth wall a lot. Things that we were told you're not supposed to do. They can sometimes be more presentational. They're always, some of the guys at work, just always out of the scene. And it's different. It's just as much fun. Improv purists would probably take issue with it. But, you know, their thing is we just want to have a good time. We want the audience to have a good time. And they achieve that. So I found in North America we tend to be a little more, you know, we the scene is God, or we have to... We do have to follow the rules, you know. We can't be shticky. We're in, you know, Britain. They love that. They love the puns. They love the wordplay, and I enjoy that too.
The thing that you learn about, you know, don't be shticky. The scene's the most important thing. Was that Johnstone?
Yeah, yeah. And I think it was one of the reasons a lot of purist improvisers had trouble with Whose Line, because it is very shticky. But it's because of the medium. Because of television, we didn't have time to, you know, build three-dimensional characters and build a scene. We had to get jokes out and get a little more sticky.
I know in Chicago, it's a long-form city, and short-form can kind of get a bad rap.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. Sometimes I also think if something gets successful, there becomes a bit of a backlash against it. I've done a lot of long form and had a great time doing it. There's a troupe in Toronto who do one act plays, and we just get a playwright, and then we interview the audience about the day or things that are happening in the city, and then based on that we do a one act play, and it's great. Everyone takes their time. Improvisers actually leave the scene and then come back adding information, and I love that. But I've also seen a lot of improv long form that can also get kind of wanky and get very precious. You know, I think it depends on what you want to give the audience. I mean, I'm not there to teach them about improv. I'm there to sort of entertain them. So I enjoy short form because that's what they know. I also enjoy long form if it can be entertaining.
We got to take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back after this.
What's your favorite short form game to play?
Oh, geez, good one. I don't know. On Whose Line, my favorite one was always Greatest Hits, because it was a chance for Ryan and I just to sort
of... For people that don't know, can you...
That would be... Ryan and I would be selling CDs. We'd set up songs, and then Wayne and Brad, or Chip Heston, would then sing songs based on whatever we gave them. But it was a chance for us to sort of riff, and there wasn't... you know, a lot of games on Whose Lines have so many... sort of gimmicks put on them that they can be really limiting. But in that one, we were actually free to just have fun with each other. And then we pass it over to this amazing musical talent who would do whatever with what we gave them. So it was a chance for me to, you know, be a participant and a spectator at the same time. So that was a game that was consistently fun for me.
Short form game that you hate.
Well, on Whose Line, it would have to be Hoedown.
Why?
Well, first of all,
the name,
the part of it, and you know, it's musical. Although lately, I've been Brad and I do some musical stuff in the show, which has been great for me because it's something that's always frightened me and scared me, and something I've never felt comfortable with.
Why? Why?
Because you need that talent thing in the music, you know. It always bothered me. It's what I love about, you know, Chip and Wayne and Brad and those guys is they will do the song, they sound great, and they get the jokes out, and it's funny. I can get the funny stuff, I will never sound great. And that always just picks at me. And it's there's
picks
nothing
at you
I can
in,
do,
in one way that you wish you could have
oh,
that.
There's times I just wish there's it's an added layer to a song when you sing beautifully, because you can also do vocal things that are comedic, playing with the style of the song that you have. I can't do that. In my head, I say, oh, it'd be really great if I do this really high note and hold it for a long time, but there's no way I can do it.
Do you ever go to like Wayne or Brad and say, oh, give me a tip? Or
they won't tell me anything.
Okay.
They're very pretty.
Yeah. I know it's very competitive on that show. Right? You don't talk
incredible.
To... You're really not friends in real life, right?
No, we're all in separate dressing rooms with trailers.
Yeah. And that happened like year three, right? You guys all turned each
up.
Other...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it was like episode three.
Okay, so,
yeah,
great.
Things happen faster in television.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
So, yeah, I have asked those guys, and they just say... you just kind of think of the end word for each, or the word you want to get to, and then you just rhyme up to that. And just go, oh yeah, that, okay, yeah, I'll do that. But then I panic, and then I always end up a line with ending a word like with suck, and you immediately go to, okay, well, the only word I'm thinking of now is a word I'm not going to use, and then you're just lost. And
I read something that you at the beginning had some problems with the censors and stuff, like in terms of where I could go, and how did you make that adjustment?
It was tough because we came from Britain where there was no censorship, so mm-hmm. everything was basically free. You were free to do anything. People were doing horrible things to the Queen, their language. There was no barrier, and not that. We took advantage of that because I think we try to stay Benny Hill clean, sort of more risque than actual, you know, just being dirty, because it's, I think it's more of a challenge to work clean. When we moved over to America, they actually had a censor in the booth because there was no script for them.
Like 20, some 22-year-old kid?
No. She was a middle-aged woman, Susan, I can't remember her last name, and she was quite lovely. But the first season, we would do a scene. There was one scene where I was in love with Greg Proops. So at one point, I kissed him. And then this voice came over the loudspeaker and said, can you make up something else? I was like... Oh, and in the previous scene, I'd killed three women and thrown them out a window. Nothing. That was fine. And so Drew had a real button on censorship. So for the next 10 minutes...
What do you mean he had a real button?
It would really upset him. So the next 10 minutes...
Why did it upset him? Because he was protecting you guys?
Yeah, and it was like, well, why is that bad, a man kissing another man? It's not... So the next 10 minutes would be kind of unusable as he would... introduce games with words that you can't say on television.
Oh, so he would that's how he would take it out.
Yeah. Yeah. He would say, okay, now we're going to play motherfucking moving bodies. And it's like, okay. So they came to an understanding that we would do the show, and then the censor and the producer would fight over things.
So they don't say anything now, or they after that, they don't say anything during the taping. They'll deal with it in post-production.
One of the best sentences I ever heard in my years in show business was Dan Patterson, the producer, ran up to me after a show and said, Colin, we lost a pussy, but we got two penises. And I thought, what is... So
it's Hollywood talk.
Yeah.
We all know that.
Well,
sure, Dan, sure.
So it was always hard to know where the line was. I mean, you knew the specifics that you weren't allowed to swear, but then there were things... I think Ryan, during a hoedown, made a mention... it was kind of, I guess, about masturbation, but he didn't say the word, but he said the word hand, and they bleeped the word hand. I thought, well... Everyone's mind has just made up a rhyme that's 10,000 times worse than the word hand. So that was tough. And then when we did Trust Us With Your Life in England...
What was that?
It was Fred Willard hosted. It was... They would have celebrities. They would tell stories from their lives, and then we would do improv based on that.
Scenes or games?
Both. A combination of both. And they had a censor fly over because it was an NBC show. And we had three notes. And one was, No swearing at all. Absolutely no swearing. The second one was, if you're going to play an old person, they can't shake. And then the last one was, if you're going to play a prostitute, they can't be really slutty. So I was like, well, then if all I wanted to do was play old prostitutes and just shake and make them really slutty. So that was the worst part. When they would tell you what you couldn't do, it was always in the back of your mind that, okay, I can't do that. So it would sort of stop you as you were improvising.
I'm totally passive aggressive. I mean, was there times you're like, screw them, I'm gonna shake, or I'm gonna.
Yeah, it got to that, and I think it's at the point now where it's much more relaxed. I think we still can't do, but we're actually. There actually has been swearing in the show, and they bleep it out, but I think we're just not worrying about it anymore. It's just, you know, we're doing the scene, and that's their job, this is our job.
What's still fun about doing that show?
Oh, well, working with the guys is always fun. It's always, because I never, Brad's the only one I see regularly, so it's always nice to see the others and sort of get back into the fun of playing with them, because it really is a good group of people, and you know, they're all kind of my best friends. So that's the main thing, and it's a it's always a challenge in a different way, because our producer Dan, who and it's because of him that the show became so popular. He really is a genius with the editing.
Because of the editing?
Yeah, he'll be in the booth. We do a taping for like 3 hours. Mm-hmm. And from that 3-hour taping, he can cut 3 or 4 shows from that. Mm-hmm. So as we're doing it, he, in his mind, is cutting shows. So the last hour, which is where we actually do the most work, because it's basically whoever the host is, Drew or Aisha, doing intros, because Dan thinks, oh, this scene we just did, that'll be good as a first scene for some show. So she'll do her intro and then sit down. Well, our first game tonight is going to be whatever.
So in a way, because, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, improvising, and until Whose Line came, improv, you didn't work on television.
Yeah.
Do you think it's that? He's basically adapted short-form games for television is why it's worked?
Yeah, yeah. He managed, because, you know, I did a pilot in Vancouver years before Whose Line, and it just, I don't know why. The improvisers were great, and the scenes, I think, were good, but it just wasn't the same. Whose Line, I think, comes the closest to getting that feel of what it's like going to an improv club and seeing some improv. There's still no substitute for seeing it live, but that comes the closest. And I think we also had it was just a lot of things that came together, and it was a perfect storm. I think the cast really helped, because everyone has their own individual styles. Everyone ended up getting sort of their own fan clubs. Everybody because everybody brings something different to the show, and we just all kind of clicked.
What are your fans like?
Oh, they're all lovely people.
There's got to be a couple crazies in there, right?
Well, I think like any a group of fans, you're going to meet some people who are odd socks. But I have to say, most people, I think one of the strange things about our fans is they all feel like they know us, because we're not playing characters. We're playing sort of exaggerated versions of ourselves. So we're not exactly like we are on television, but we're pretty close. So they all feel like they know us. So, you know, my fans just tend to come up and do bald jokes at me, which is like bizarre.
And how do you take that?
Well, I just go, well, whatever.
Right.
But there are times when, you know, I once had someone come up who had like thick glasses, was a hunchback, and was very overweight, and he did a bald joke, and I thought, I can't do anything. There's like right. 3 or 4 jokes I could come up with, but then I'll be the bad guy. So you just kind of swallow it. And, you know, it certainly doesn't bother me. It became one of the things I was known for on the show. Although, at this point, I think I'm one of the least bald people on the show.
Are you mad that they made so many bald jokes on that show?
No, I always knew. Oh, God.
You don't seem like you're happy about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was acting.
Right.
part of it was I thought, oh, God, poor guys, they don't have anything.
Right.
Because when they had nothing, I thought, oh, here comes a bald joke. And
right.
It would. And I think it got the audience more on my side. So it was. It
did they ever come up to you after going, I'm sorry, I didn't have anything to say? Or did.
Wayne did once. I wonder if I should tell this story.
Please.
Okay. Wayne came up to me once and said, before the show, he said, you know what? I'm not going to do any bald jokes tonight. And I went, yeah, okay, whatever. He goes, no, I won't. I said, Wayne, if someone does a bald joke, you'll jump in there. I understand that. It'll happen. He goes, no, I'll tell you what. If I do a bald joke, you can call me Darkie. And I went, okay, there's a difference. There's a big difference. You give a bald joke, people will laugh and have fun.
Right.
I call you Darkie, that's a whole different thing. And he went, yeah, I guess you're right. And he did do a bald joke.
How do you think the show has had an impact on improv since you started?
I think it just got it out there into the sort of public consciousness. And I always said to people, you know, Whose Line is not the end-all and be-all of improv. I always sort of, it's almost like the vaudeville of improv. It'll get you started. You'll see, oh, this is the basic thing. They make up stuff. But there's so many different forms, especially now since Whose Line. But it got it out there. It got people excited about it. You know, we would have people always come up to us and say, you know, we started improv groups in, you know, almost kindergarten, colleges. It became a big thing, especially in the 80s. There seemed to be a real explosion of it. So I always felt, oh, we sort of had a hand in that, for better or for worse.
You're touring around with this show with Brad.
Mm-hmm.
And what have you learned working with Brad?
Oh, that I work better alone. But what I love working about Brad is we're never satisfied. We're always trying to find ways of making the show better, making it more challenging for us. We would, and there was always simple solutions to things. When we would come up with a set list for what we were doing, we would spend so much time trying to figure out what are we going to ask for the audience so that, and then I came up with what I thought a brilliant idea. I thought, well, this has got a bunch of cards, and we'll write suggestions. And then we'll get, when we have an audience member come, they pick a card, we'll go, oh, okay, so can we have an obscure activity? So that took a lot of pressure off us. And it also, I think, freed us up to think, okay, it really made us even improvise more.
That's interesting that there was pressure on coming up with the suggestions.
Yeah. Because it was always okay, because we also wanted to try to get the audience to get out of shouting gynecologists and proctologists every time you ask for a suggestion. So we would come up with ways, like one we've done recently is, what was your great-grandmother or grandfather's profession? So we get them thinking of, oh, unless they were actually a gynecologist, then we're screwed. But so we found, but actually by writing on the cards, to make the ask for a little more specific, so they actually have to work a little more giving us something.
How much is your chemistry dependent on, like, a two-person show is a very intimate, it's you and somebody else. A group of five, eight, 10 people, you can kind of get lost. How important is that chemistry with you and Brad?
It's really important. It's important to have, first of all, that trust in someone. That, you know, there's, I would say most of the time we know where each of us are going in a scene. But the times that we don't, we trust each other enough to just, okay, I don't know where this is going, but I'm going to follow because I know him and I've worked with him. And we have a real, almost like a sibling, I guess, relationship. I'm a little bit older than him. He's like the little annoying kid brother. And I think that comes across when we're
in relationships in the scenes, right?
Relationships and on stage, you know, as we're talking and setting up scenes too. We also have that sort of relationship.
It's a father and son team.
Yeah, I like to think older brother, younger brother.
we've got to wrap this up. And this has just been great. I really appreciate you doing this. We ask the same question to all our guests, and that is, what one piece of advice would you give an improviser starting out today?
First, don't. Do something better.
Are you serious about that?
I'm not.
I mean,
a lot of people get in. I find a lot of people got into it. Or I found a lot of people say, "How do I get onto Whose Line? How do we get a TV show?" And I think, well, that's not why. Because there wasn't one. I got into it because I loved doing it, and I loved working with the people I was working with, and it was exciting for me. So I always say, make sure you're doing it for the right reason.
Because you don't seem like an improviser who wants to get a TV show. You seem to really love improvising.
Oh, absolutely. This is the most fun. The fact I'm doing something that wasn't an occupation when I was growing up still boggles my mind. And every night, no matter how bad I'm feeling, physically or mentally, once I'm out on stage, it's all gone.
Even when you do a bad show?
Okay, well, that's a different...
I'm serious. How do you handle a bad show?
I tend to blame the audience. A bad show, that's the hardest thing, is just letting it go, because it happens. There's no one that ever has good show after good show. There was a show, Ryan Brad and I did, and I think it was before Whose Line, but we were doing it in a comedy club in L.A., and we just sucked the air out of that theater. It was so bad. Once it was over, we all just left, got in our cars, and went home, and we didn't see each other for 3 weeks. It just was horrible.
He told that story in his episode.
Yeah.
He said a couple...
Did
you
blame
wouldn't.
Me?
No, he didn't blame anybody. I don't know if he blamed the audience. You did.
Partly it was an audience filled with other improv group. So there was a lot
Which
of
Which is like a
there.
Firing squad.
And also because we were doing so badly, we went way long because we figured, no, we're going to save this. And it just got worse and worse. But at this point, you have a bad show. We're fairly lucky. It's because a lot of times what you think was a horrible show, to them, the audience still loved. We've done shows where we thought, wow, they're going to want their money back. And then people come up afterwards and just say, that was the funniest thing I've ever seen. I just loved it. And you go, oh, great.
I would like this. It was funnier than Whose Line. Do you ever get that?
Yes, we have had that. That always feels good because it's different from Whose Line. I mean, we play a lot of the same games, but because the scenes are longer, we have more time to explore it, and we're just free to do anything. I think, here's my advice to someone who wants to improvise. The hardest thing to work on is trusting yourself to go out on stage with absolutely nothing. So you have to find a way to do that.
What do you mean, absolutely nothing?
To go out and don't think, oh, you know, hey, when we do the sound effects game, maybe we should, I'm going to maybe have an animal in the scene for some reason and do something with that. It's having a trust in yourself and your partner just to go out and go, whatever happens, happens. Whatever the audience gives us, that's what we're playing with. Whatever my partner gives me, that's what we're playing with. Whatever I come up with, that's it. We're not going to plan anything. We're just going to have fun. Don't think and have fun.
Colin Mochrie, thank you so much for being our guest on this episode of Improv Nerd.
Thank you.
And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. I want to thank our guest, Colin Mochrie, and also the Genesee Theater in Waukegan. And, oh my God, our Improv Nerd team was incredible. And for me, when I go to a location like we did down in the green room at the Genesee, it's so much fun when you interview people in TV to bring your crew, you know? And we've got the cordless mics and the two video cameras. And these guys, Dan Schiffmacher, Sam Bowers, and let me see, I hope I get Joe Pizzanzio, I got his name right. These guys come in, they're so professional, they've worked together, they've worked with me, and it's just so impressive. Like, I feel like I leave and I'm proud of what we do. And you know, me, it's very hard for me to feel good about anything, but I feel good about, you know, just the professionalism of how we work. So I want to thank those guys for making this episode and recording it and videotaping it. Also, if you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes, workshops, and intensives called The Art of Slow Comedy, and to sign up for the Improv Nerd blog, go to my website at jimmycorain.com. As you know, we are slowly taking over social media, so go to our Facebook page, Improv Nerd, and like us, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter at @improv_nerd, and you got to check out our Improv Nerd YouTube channel, and you will see clips from our live show, or we also took clips from these live interviews, and that's Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word. We're lucky enough to be part of this podcast collective called Feral Audio. So check out all their great podcasts at feralaudio.com. Also, if you buy something from Amazon, go to feralaudio.com before and hit the buy now button, and it takes you to Amazon. And so it supports Feral Audio. It supports Improv Nerd. So do that before you buy. And we're buying everything from Amazon now. I mean, it would really help us out. I've got to go. I want to thank you guys for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it. And here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right. Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL. The 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban, and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans, and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air, and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype, and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pe in Spanish,
oh my gosh.
He spots his dear friend, who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my God.